Karen Hartglass. We're back. You know, I love listening to that music. My brother wrote it, and I always get into it every time. I've been listening to it now for 4 years plus, and I never get tired of it. Isn't that good? That means it's good. It's good music. Just gets me into the groove. All right, it's March 4th, 2014. Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, IHOP National Pancake Day, and it's time for the second part of It's All About Food. And we're going to dig in now with my next guest, Lee Hall, an author who's taken on subjects from anti-terrorism law to vegan cooking, wrote the Vegetarianism's entry in the Encyclopedia of Activism and Social Justice. Lee has taught animal law and immigration and refugee law and is today working on a second law degree, a legal master's in environmental law, with a focus on climate change from Vermont Law School. Lee's work is a bridge between environmentalism and our personal relationships with agriculture, confronting the way animal farming usurps habitat. For years, animal rights advocates have operated under the belief that at least pasture-based or organic ranching represents a step in the humane direction, but only looking at how domesticated animals seem to be affected. Lee champions the animal communities displaced by farm sprawl and explains how our chosen cookbooks can offer a genuine, humane response for all animals, reduce greenhouse emissions, and even stop extinctions. Lee Hall, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen, and it seems to be perfect timing given that you're the lone vegan ready to speak with 200 cattle ranchers.
I know, and I was hoping that you would give me some really good tips for Saturday.
I'm imagining that we're going to have quite a good conversation given that we're both studying the same thing right now.
I know, and the first thing I wanted to ask you, I've been following you and your work for a long time, and it's incredible. And the thing that I know about you is your intensity, your passion, your how principled you are. And
you.
I wondered, were you born that way, or was there, or was there something that happened in your life that made that happen, or was it, you know, a slow process, or none of the above?
Well, no, I wasn't born that way. I actually saw a bullfight when I was a child. And, you know, that didn't change me. And I look back on it, maybe it did, you know, ultimately. But I look back on it and I think, you know, why didn't that change me? Why? Witnessing a bullfight. I mean, the bull was killed. This was in Mexico. My parents worked there. They got free tickets from a business associate, right? So we went and we saw the novicios, which are the people who are learning to do bullfights, which I understand is more difficult to watch. I wouldn't know. I've only seen, you know, this particular instance. And I hid myself in the bathroom for over a day. I wouldn't come out after it. I guess I thought was weirdest was, you know, as terrible as this was, as traumatic as it was to see, to hear people standing up and cheering for the slow death of an animal, not to mention what the horses were also going through in the ring. I, of all the horrific feeling of this, I think the very worst was that there were I was surrounded by hundreds of people who were cheering.
Yeah.
And so here I am locking myself in the bathroom, and I remember trying to make a soap carving for hours. And I heard my mother trying to get me out of the bathroom saying, you know, it's all right. The meat, the flesh of the bull will go to the poor children of Mexico. Well, my mother knew that I was very concerned about poverty. I did have a feeling of social justice. As a little kid, as I think most little kids do. But I look back on it and I think, you know, there was the tie right there. My mother was telling me. And, of course, that didn't help me feel better, that they were going to eat the bull. But why didn't I connect? as a child, why didn't I connect? And I know people who do. They see an animal killed and immediately they put it all together and that's it for them.
But most don't.
Most don't. It takes, I don't know what happens. I don't know how. If I knew how to make this all work, I would tell you. But I was 21 and I met Robin Raine, who is now the co-facilitator of and the founder of the London Vegan Festival, which is the longest running vegan festival anywhere in the world. It's the one that inspired all the vegan festivals to come. But this was, you know, long before that had been started. And Robin had only been, Robin Raine in London had been vegan for 1 year and met me. And I'm, as far as we know, Robin's longest running protege. And Robin, it was a leaflet. You know, it was a leaflet. It was all the ways we use animals. And I considered myself a feminist. That's one of the areas I was reading about the most, feminism. And,
yes.
And something just clicked right there and then. It was, how can I think about oppression and want to get over oppression and want to transcend that in my life and be working so hard mentally to transcend differences and hierarchies and have not noticed this before? And then of course the bullfight came back to me, but I just said, well, that'll be it. And so I'm one of the weird people that actually did decide to go vegan all at once.
Yay, so for the weird people. Let's hear it from the socially peculiar. Yay.
<Thank you. laughs>
Making the world a better place.
So that was 31 years ago.
Yeah. Good for you. Well, I just wonder, because I want to think that we all have the potential to not exploit, to not cause pain and suffering. I want to believe that, and I want to believe we're not born with one kind of DNA that makes us more compassionate than others. I want to think we're all flexible, and once the veil is lifted, we can move on and do better.
Well, I think that's true, Karen, because otherwise, I mean, I was that person until I was 21. I knew. And I didn't change. So I look at other people as people who could change any day. I mean, you've had Harold Brown on the show.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's a wonderful example. Harold came from a dairy and beef farming family and would have been a successful dairy and beef farmer today. Had been doing that for many, many years, and then, you know, a light bulb went off. This was somebody who also hunted regularly.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. You're in environmental law now, and I want to talk a little bit more about animals and the environment. So one of the things we're hearing about people that care about the environment and seem to have more compassion for animals. They want to go for the more, quote, humane ways of raising animals for food, pasture grazing.
Right.
And I'm doing my studying for this climate change talk. There's a guy on the panel who believes in animal agriculture intensification because, unfortunately, we've learned that animal agriculture intensification is, quote, more efficient and produces less greenhouse gases when you're cramming these animals in a small space and feeding them the wrong foods. But nobody talks about all the things that are wrong with it. But it's encouraging this horror instead of the other way around. And let's just talk about how all these different things affect the environment.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. That's a very interesting sort of squeeze that you bring up.
Huh.
I mean, you mentioned that, well, the intensified farming can be controlled in a way that it's less of an emitter of greenhouse gases, that it takes up less space environmentally, these kinds of things. And, you know, that's a significant point to bring up because I think a lot of advocates want to think, well, everything about factory farms is wrong and that's the answer. You know, we just say that. We just say factory farms and we're saying something that, of course, everybody understands. But it's all kinds of animal farms. The problem we're dealing with is animal farming. It's not factory farming. Certainly not factory farming per se. It's animal farming. Any kind of animal farming has its problems. You know, we as animal advocates or as environmentalists, we understand sprawl. We know what that means. And yet, we don't see it when it's happening with farms that are being spread out. We will say, well, that's a step in the right direction. Well, how can that be if in the United States we are outnumbered by farm land animals 5 to 1?
Mm-hmm.
So how could it be that the problem is intensive farming? How could it be that it's a step in the right direction to have these pasture-based farms when we're walking around, 300 million of us in this country, and we are outnumbered 5 to 1 by, and that's just the land farm animals. So the problem isn't the factory. The problem is both. If you've got the concentrated farms, what you've got is this dense runoff. You've got emissions. You do have emissions. They may be controlling them to some extent, but they're still there. You still have ruminant animals, and they're still emitting methane. There is fine particulate matter that's going up into the air, and all the things that lead to acid rain. That is
And they happening. Still make manure, piles of it.
They, no matter how they're raised. I mean,
that's
if you've
right.
Got farm
the shit continues, yeah.
It's in either one. When you've got the expanded farms, the pasture-based, the grass-fed, you've got other situations, the destruction, and of course with the intensive farm, you've got all the humane questions. You know, all the whole idea that humanity would treat animals as things to put into tiny boxes. You know, that's there. But when you've got expansion, of course, you know, at the end we're killing them. We know that, so that there's a myth that it can be humane because they're being slaughtered at the end, but there's more. When you expand a farm, you're fragmenting habitat. You are setting the stage for systematic predator control, and that is followed by a cascade of consequences. So when you've got...
What is systematic predator control?
Well, for example, coyotes. Coyotes and foxes are the animals who are normally targeted. So, with coyotes, you know, they're around pastures, right? And they're irritating to farmers. Obviously, a coyote, a bobcat, a fox, a wolf, a grizzly bear is going to be tempted, understandably, right, to eat an animal. So mm-hmm. the more free range the farm is, the more vulnerable mm-hmm. to predators these farm animals are. So what do? Shooting coyotes is legal in most places. Coyotes can be shot from aircraft. There are forms of poison. The very first synthetic coyote attractant, which was made to kill them, a lure that was made to attract them and kill them, debuted in 1973, and it was derived from the fatty acids of rhesus monkeys' vaginal secretions.
Ew.
Since then, we have had it come up with all sorts of poisons and lures to attract foxes and coyotes, and one infamous one is called Compound 1080. It goes into what's called predicide collars. Now, those are strapped onto free-range goats and lambs. So here's this poison. It will not save the goat or the lamb. The point is that the coyote goes up to the animal, and if the coyote bites the neck of that farm animal, that coyote is about to enter hell.
Mm.
This poison takes somewhere between 3 and 15 hours to kill.
Mm.
Then there are the traps, the snares, the M44s, which is another lure that Wildlife Services, our federal government, uses to help ranchers. These poisons are often picked up by pets, bald eagles, turkey vultures, wolves, unintended animals, migratory shorebirds, otters, porcupines, mountain lions. So all these things are happening out there with the free-range farms, and to say, well, let's stop factory farming, totally ignores that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, and who thinks up these things? Who thinks up these poisons and these traps for people?
Are you there?
Yes. Oh, I hear you. Do you hear me?
Hello?
Hello. Oops. Hey, can somebody help us here? Hello? Okay. Well, I'm sorry that Lee can't hear us because... I'm sorry Lee can't hear us because she's been talking about some incredible things. And what I'm wondering about is who are these scientists, these educated scientists that invent these incredible killing materials, the minds that come up with these things? So the thing we're talking about is, okay, Lee, you're back.
I'm back.
Oh, gosh. Somebody didn't want you hearing what we were talking about. Okay.
It sounds like it, yeah.
The conspiracy continues. Anyway, so this is incredible what goes on with pasture grazing and systematic predators and how we just get rid of anything that gets in our way.
Yes. Did you hear what I said about poisoning? I'm not sure when we lost each other.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was all very fascinating. Okay, so there are all these compassionate, quote, compassionate people that want to get humane-raised animals and go for the pasture, and there's all these issues with that. And then, of course, there's the intensified farms, and the point is they're all animal farms. And when we look at it from an environmental point of view, the winner is the one that nobody's looking at, which is feeding plants to people directly.
Exactly. And you know, people are looking at it, but maybe not looking at it in a way that connects it directly with their plate. I'm in school right now studying with the scientists and lawyers, and I'm seeing that the people in environmental law course are aware that, for example, there's this study out by Christopher Weber and Scott Matthews at Carnegie Mellon, and they have done calculations of greenhouse gas emissions, and they have said a protein shift, that is their word for it, when you get protein and nutrients from plants directly instead of feeding all these animals and then getting your nutrients through the animals that have been killed, when you do this protein shift one day a week, it would be like driving 1,160 miles less every year. Now, what they're talking about is sort of like a vegan Monday, aren't they? Because
yeah.
They're saying replace red meat and dairy, and this is what would happen, 1,160 miles less a year. Well, that suggests that animal agribusiness per se is non-local. If that is the kind of difference that you can create, then you can't really say, oh, well, this is local, so it's sustainable. Because if you cut it out of your diet, even one day, it would be more than 1,000 miles equivalent that you weren't driving. So right there, they're getting somewhere. But take this to the, and this is what I bring up when we're having these conversations. Wait a minute. What did you just say? Because a seven-day-a-week shift means that's more than 8,000 miles as though you were not driving every year.
Mm-hmm.
More than 8,000 miles. Well, if you've got that kind of power, and a vegan has it, you know, but anybody can have that kind of power, and they could have it at dinner. They could decide right now. Why not? Being vegan in North America is not a real big difficulty. And so obviously, and it would decrease all this hurt and all this harm caused by climate chaos, caused by the taking away of habitat from other animals. It's ranching is taking away the other animals' habitat. That's what it does. We've got in the last 500 years, more animals have gone extinct in the United States than any place else in the world.
Mm.
We are wrecking this land and water for ranching.
You know, this show is called It's All About Food, but, you know, it really is all about money. And the animal food industry is a $160 billion a year industry in the United States. So I'm thinking I'm going to be talking to these cattle producers and telling them we need to reduce or eliminate animal livestock. And I'm getting right to the heart of their livelihood. What do we tell people like that?
Yes. Well, there has always been forms of livelihood that economies have depended on. We've had to say there's a problem with this, that we need to transcend this and start acting differently. I mean, you can think of three or four examples right now. The chocolate slavery, it's not okay. It chocolate companies, there's massive chocolate companies, and they're selling loads and loads of chocolate at the expense of people on the Ivory Coast who are selling their children into slavery.
Right, child slavery.
Mm-hmm. It's not okay. I mean, you know this.
Yeah, it's not okay. But, you know, most people don't know about it. And
right.
It's taken a long time to get Hershey's chocolate to budge.
Well, and yes. And when you're out there talking to 200 people who are cattle ranchers, you're also talking to many, many, many more. Not that you're going to videotape yourself or anything like that. But, you know, people know what you're doing. They're asking you questions. They're looking at your radio show. And maybe you'll videotape yourself.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, including environmentalists, need to know this, Karen. It's not just the cattle ranchers that you are informing, that you're having these conversations with. We're talking to loads of people. We're talking about getting to a tipping point. And because of climate change is upon us, we may well be right about at that tipping point.
Well, then there were plenty of people, and there's one guy on the panel that I'm going to be speaking with who is a climate change denier and doesn't believe it's happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
And who is now connected with the Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN.
You know, and it's really hard to know. We live in a very complex world. There's a lot of information on the Internet, but it takes a lot to figure out what's credible and what isn't, and I can't go into every lab and see what they're doing. Now, when I read things in a study that I think are interesting, I'll go to the original source. I'll read whatever I can, see how the study was done, and see if I think it was good or not, and if it's something I want to repeat. But most people don't do that, and still, we cannot possibly check on everyone. So some things we have to just take on faith. And when it comes to climate change, nobody really knows what's going on. But we do see lots of things going on in the environment that shouldn't be going on. We have polluted air, polluted water. We're running out of water. Things that we're doing are not sustainable, and they have to change, or the game's over.
Well, we do know that the carbon dioxide level in our atmosphere is at its highest point in more than 600,000 years geologic history. We do know that average global temperatures, although they are fluctuating madly, are higher now than they've been for over 10,000 years.
But some people don't believe that. I mean, I agree that I've seen that data, and there are people that just say it's not true.
Well, now it's becoming part of policies.
Yeah, there are 97% of climate change scientists that believe the planet is warming.
Exactly. Yeah. So then the question becomes, how much is it from animal farming? And the consensus seems to be it's about one-fifth. But, as you know, specialists from the World Bank, including Robert Goodland, who unfortunately passed away recently, have said it's more like 51% is attributable to animal agribusiness. And so Mark Bittman invited Robert Goodland to do a blog on Mark Bittman's column for the New York Times. And Robert Goodland wrote, one might expect the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations to work objectively to let us know, to determine whether the true figure is closer to a fifth or 51%. But instead, Frank Mitlerner, known for the claiming that the fifth is too big of a figure to use in the United States, was announced as chair of a new partnership between the meat industry and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. So Mark Bittman titled that guest blog FAO, which is the UN, yields to meat industry pressure on climate change. That's very, very frightening.
It is frightening. And you know what? We're going to have to talk about this some more another time because we're out of time.
All right.
Can you believe it?
No.
Yeah, I know. So I'm going to have you back, and we're going to have to dig more into this, especially after I'm on this panel with Frank Mitlohner and see what he has to say.
Great.
Lee,
okay.
Thank you so much for joining me this half hour and for all the work that you're doing. And I hope to see you sometime soon and we can have some delicious food, vegan
That's
food, the best.
That's a wonderful idea. Meanwhile, I'm rooting for the lone vegan.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, everybody, we've come to the end of It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. And remember, please have a delicious week.